This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Dr. Sleep by Stephen King. Read by Will Patton. With an author's note read by Stephen King.
Hi, this is Stephen King. When I was playing my primitive brand of rhythm guitar with a group called the Rock Bottom Remainders, Warren Zevon used to gig with us. Warren loved gray t-shirts and movies like Kingdom of the Spiders. He insisted I sing lead on his signature tune, Werewolves of London, during the encore portion of our shows. I said I was not worthy. He insisted that I was. Key of G, Warren told me, and howl like you mean it. Most important of all, play like Keith. I'll never be able to play like Keith Richards, but I always did my best, and with Warren beside me, matching me note for note and laughing his fool head off, I always had a blast. Warren, this howl is for you, wherever you are. I miss you, buddy.
We stood at the turning point. Half measures availed us nothing. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. It is the dubious luxury of normal men and women. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Prefatory Matters. Fear stands for fuck everything and run. Old AA saying. Lockbox. 1. On the second day of December, in a year when a Georgia peanut farmer was doing business in the White House, one of Colorado's great resort hotels burned to the ground. The Overlook was declared a total loss. After an investigation, the fire marshal of Jicarilla County ruled the cause had been a defective boiler. The hotel was closed for the winter when the accident occurred, and only 4 people were present. 3 survived. The hotel's off-season caretaker, John Torrance, was killed during an unsuccessful and heroic effort to dump the boiler's steam pressure, which had mounted to disastrously high levels due to an inoperative relief valve. 2 of the survivors were the caretaker's wife and young son. The 3rd was the Overlook's chef, Richard Halloran, who had left his seasonal job in Florida and come to check on the Torrances because of what he called a powerful hunch that the family was in trouble. Both surviving adults were quite badly injured in the explosion. Only the child was unhurt. Physically, at least. 2. Wendy Torrance and her son received a settlement from the corporation that owned the Overlook. It wasn't huge, but enough to get them by for the 3 years she was unable to work because of back injuries. A lawyer she consulted told her that if she were willing to hold out and play tough, she might get a great deal more because the corporation was anxious to avoid a court case. But she, like the corporation, wanted only to put that disastrous winter in Colorado behind her. She would convalesce, she said, and she did, although back injuries plagued her until the end of her life. Shattered vertebrae and broken ribs heal, but they never cease crying out. Winifred and Daniel Torrance lived in the Mid-South for a while, then drifted down to Tampa. Sometimes Dick Halloran, he of the powerful hunches, came up from Key West to visit with them, to visit with young Danny especially. They shared a bond. One early morning in March of 1981, Wendy called Dick and asked if he could come. Danny, she said, had awakened her in the night and told her not to go in the bathroom. After that, he refused to talk at all. 3. he woke up needing to pee. Outside, a strong wind was blowing. It was warm. In Florida, it almost always was, but he did not like that sound, and supposed he never would. It reminded him of the Overlook, where the defective boiler had been the very least of the dangers. He and his mother lived in a cramped second-floor tenement apartment. Danny left the little room next to his mother's and crossed the hall. The wind gusted, and a dying palm tree beside the building clattered its leaves. The sound was skeletal. They always left the bathroom door open when no one was using the shower or the toilet because the lock was broken. Tonight the door was closed. Not because his mother was in there, however. Thanks to facial injuries she'd suffered at the Overlook, she now snored, a soft queep, queep sound, and he could hear it coming from her bedroom. Well, she closed it by accident, that's all. He knew better. Even then, he was possessed of powerful hunches and intuitions himself. But sometimes, you had to know. Sometimes, you had to see. This was something he had found out at the Overlook, in a room on the second floor. Reaching with an arm that seemed too long, too stretchy, too boneless, he turned the knob and opened the door. The woman from room 217 was there, as he had known she would be. She was sitting naked on the toilet, with her legs spread and her pallid thighs bulging. Her greenish breasts hung down, like deflated balloons. The patch of hair below her stomach was gray. Her eyes were also gray, like steel mirrors. She saw him, and her lips stretched back in a grin. "Close your eyes," Dick Halloran had told him once upon a time. "If you see something bad, close your eyes and tell yourself it's not there, and when you open them again, it will be gone." But it hadn't worked in room 217 when he was 5, and it wouldn't work now. He knew it. He could smell her. She was decaying. The woman, he knew her name, it was Mrs. Massey, lumbered to her purple feet, holding out her hands to him. The flesh on her arms hung down, almost dripping. She was smiling the way you do when you see an old friend, or perhaps something good to eat. With an expression that could have been mistaken for calmness, Danny closed the door softly and stepped back. He watched as the knob turned right, left, right again, then stilled. He was 8 now, and capable of at least some rational thought, even in his horror. Partly because, in a deep part of his mind, he had been expecting this. Although he'd always thought it would be Horace Derwent who would eventually show up, or perhaps the bartender, the one his father had called Lloyd. He supposed he should have known it would be Mrs. Massey, though, even before it finally happened, because of all the undead things in the Overlook, she had been the worst. The rational part of his mind told him she was just a fragment of unremembered bad dream that had followed him out of sleep and across the hall to the bathroom. That part insisted that if he opened the door again, there would be nothing there. Surely there wouldn't be, now that he was awake. But another part of him, a part that shone, knew better. The Overlook wasn't done with him. At least one of its vengeful spirits had followed him all the way to Florida. Once he had come upon that woman sprawled in a bathtub, she had gotten out and tried to choke him with her fishy but terribly strong fingers. If he opened the bathroom door now, she would finish the job. He compromised by putting his ear against the door. At first there was nothing. Then he heard a faint sound. Dead fingernails scratching on wood. Danny walked into the kitchen on not their legs, stood on a chair, and peed into the sink. Then he woke his mother and told her not to go into the bathroom because there was a bad thing there. Once that was done, he went back to bed and sank deep beneath the covers. He wanted to stay there forever, only getting up to pee in the sink. Now that he had warned his mother, he had no interest in talking to her. His mother knew about the no-talking thing. It had happened after Danny had ventured into room 217 at the Overlook. "Will you talk to Dick?" Lying in his bed, looking up at her, he nodded. His mother called, even though it was 4 in the morning. Late the next day, Dick came. He brought something with him. A present. 4. After Wendy called Dick, she made sure Danny heard her doing it. Danny went back to sleep. Although he was now 8 and in the 3rd grade, he was sucking his thumb. It hurt her to see him do that. She went to the bathroom door and stood looking at it. She was afraid. Danny had made her afraid. But she had to go, and she had no intention of using the sink as he had. The image of how she would look teetering on the edge of the counter with her butt hanging over the porcelain, even if there was no one there to see, made her wrinkle her nose. In one hand, she had the hammer from her little box of widow's tools. As she turned the knob and pushed the bathroom door open, she raised it. The bathroom was empty, of course, but the ring of the toilet seat was down. She never left it that way before going to bed, because she knew if Danny wandered in only 10% awake, he was apt to forget to put it up and piss all over it. Also, there was a smell. A bad one. As if a rat had died in the walls. She took a step in, then 2. She saw movement and whirled, hammer upraised, to hit whoever, whatever, was hiding behind the door. But it was only her shadow. Scared of her own shadow, people sometimes sneered. But who had a better right than Wendy Torrance? After the things she had seen and been through, she knew that shadows could be dangerous. They could have teeth. No one was in the bathroom, but there was a discolored smear on the toilet seat and another one on the shower curtain. Excrement was her first thought, but shit wasn't yellowish purple. She looked more closely and saw bits of flesh and decayed skin. There was more on the bath mat in the shape of footprints. She thought them too small, too dainty, to be a man's. "Oh, God," she whispered. She ended up using the sink after all. 5. Wendy nagged her son out of bed at noon. She managed to get a little soup and half a peanut butter sandwich into him, but then he went back to bed. He still wouldn't speak. Halloran arrived shortly after 5 in the afternoon behind the wheel of his now ancient but perfectly maintained and blindingly polished red Cadillac. Wendy had been standing at the window, waiting and watching as she had once waited and watched for her husband, hoping Jack would come home in a good mood and sober. She rushed down the stairs and opened the door just as Dick was about to ring the bell marked Torrance 2A. He held out his arms and she rushed into them at once, wishing she could be enfolded there for at least an hour, maybe 2. He let go and held her at arm's length by her shoulders. "You're looking fine, Wendy. How's the little man? He talking again?"
"No, but he'll talk to you, even if he won't do it out loud to start with. You can..."
Instead of finishing, she made a finger gun and pointed it at his forehead.
"Not necessarily," Dick said. His smile revealed a bright new pair of false teeth. The Overlook had taken most of the last set on the night the boiler blew. Jack Torrance swung the mallet that took Dick's dentures and Wendy's ability to walk without a hitch in her stride, but they both understood it had really been the Overlook. "He's very powerful, Wendy. If he wants to block me out, he will. I know from my own experience. Besides, it'd be better if we talk with our mouths. Better for him. Now tell me everything that happened."
After she did that, Wendy took him into the bathroom. She had left the stains for him to see like a beat cop preserving the scene of a crime for the forensic team. And there had been a crime, one against her boy. Dick looked for a long time, not touching, then nodded. Let's see if Danny's up and in the doings. He wasn't, but Wendy's heart was lightened by the look of gladness that came into her son's face when he saw who was sitting beside him on the bed and shaking his shoulder. Hey, Danny, I brought you a present. It's not my birthday. Wendy watched them, knowing they were speaking but not knowing what it was about. Dick said, Get on up, honey. We're going to take a walk on the beach. Dick, she came back. Mrs. Massey from room 217 came back. Dick gave his shoulder another shake. Talk out loud, Dan. You're scaring your ma. Danny said, What's my present? Dick smiled. That's better. I like to hear you, and Wendy does too. Yes, it was all she dared say. Otherwise they'd hear the tremble in her voice and be concerned. She didn't want that. While we're gone, you might want to give the bathroom a cleaning, Dick said to her. Have you got kitchen gloves? She nodded. Good. Wear them. 6. The beach was 2 miles away. The parking lot was surrounded by tawdry beachfront attractions, funnel cake concessions, hot dog stands, souvenir shops. But this was the tag end of the season and none were doing much business. They had the beach itself almost entirely to themselves. On the ride from the apartment, Danny had held his present, an oblong package, quite heavy, wrapped in silver paper, on his lap. You can open it after we talk a bit, Dick said. They walked just above the waves where the sand was hard and gleaming. Danny walked slowly because Dick was pretty old. Someday he'd die. Maybe even soon. I'm good to go another few years, Dick said. Don't you worry about that. Now tell me about last night. Don't leave anything out. It didn't take long. The hard part would have been finding words to explain the terror he now felt and how it was mingled with a suffocating sense of certainty. Now that she'd found him, she'd never leave. But because it was Dick, he didn't need words, although he found some. She'll come back. I know she will. She'll come back and come back until she gets me. Do you remember when we met? Although surprised at the change of direction, Danny nodded. It had been Halloran who gave him and his parents the guided tour on their first day at the Overlook. Very long ago, that seemed. And do you remember the first time I spoke up inside your head? I sure do. What did I say? You asked me if I wanted to go to Florida with you. That's right. And how did it make you feel to know you wasn't alone anymore? That you wasn't the only one? It was great, Danny said. It was so great. Yeah, Halloran said. Yeah, of course it was. They walked in silence for a bit. Little birds, peeps, Danny's mother called them, ran in and out of the waves. Did it ever strike you funny how I showed up when you needed me? He looked down at Danny and smiled. No, it didn't. Why would it? You was just a child, but you're a little older now. A lot older in some ways. Listen to me, Danny. The world has a way of keeping things in balance. I believe that. There's a saying, when the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. I was your teacher. You were a lot more than that, Danny said. He took Dick's hand. You were my friend. You saved us. Dick ignored this, or seemed to. My grandma also had the shining. Do you remember me telling you that? Yeah, you said you and her could have long conversations without even opening your mouths. That's right. She taught me. And it was her great-grandma that taught her way back in the slave days. Someday, Danny, it will be your turn to be the teacher. The pupil will come. If Mrs. Massey doesn't get me first, Danny said morosely. They came to a bench. Dick sat down. I don't dare go any further. I might not make it back. Sit beside me. I want to tell you a story. I don't want stories, Danny said. She'll come back. Don't you get it? She'll come back and come back and come back. Shut your mouth and open your ears. Take some instruction. Then Dick grinned, displaying his gleaming new dentures. I think you'll get the point. You're far from stupid, honey. 7. Dick's mother's mother, the one with the shining, lived in Clearwater. She was the white grandma. Not because she was Caucasian, of course, but because she was good. His father's father lived in Dunbury, Mississippi, a rural community not far from Oxford. His wife had died long before Dick was born. For a man of color, in that place and time, he was wealthy. He owned a funeral parlor. Dick and his parents visited 4 times a year, and young Dick Halloran hated those visits. He was terrified of Andy Halloran, and called him, only in his own mind, to speak it aloud would have earned him a smack across the chops, the black grandpa. "You know about kiddie fiddlers?" Dick asked Danny. "Guys who want children for sex?" "Sort of," Danny said cautiously. Certainly he knew not to talk to strangers and never to get into a car with one, because they might do stuff to you.
"Well, old Andy was more than a kiddie fiddler. He was a damn sadist as well."
"What's that?"
"Someone who enjoys giving pain."
Danny nodded in immediate understanding. "Like Frankie Lestrone at school, he gives kids Indian burns and Dutch rubs. If he can't make you cry, he stops. If he can, he never stops."
"That's bad, but this was worse."
Dick lapsed into what would have looked like silence to a passerby, but the story went forward in a series of pictures and connecting phrases. Danny saw the black grandpa, a tall man in a suit as black as he was, who wore a special kind of
fedora
hat on his head. He saw how there were always little buds of spittle at the corners of his mouth, and how his eyes were red-rimmed like he was tired or had just gotten over crying. He saw how he would take Dick, younger than Danny was now, probably the same age he'd been that winter at the Overlook, on his lap. If they weren't alone, he might only tickle. If they were, he'd put his hand between Dick's legs and squeeze his balls until Dick thought he'd faint with the pain.
"Do you like that?" Grandpa Andy would pant in his ear. He smelled of cigarettes and white horse scotch. "Cause you do. Every boy likes that. But even if you don't, you dasn't tell. If you do, I'll hurt you. I'll burn you."
"Holy shit," Danny said. "That's gross."
"There were other things, too," Dick said. "But I'll just tell you one. Grampy hired a woman to help out around the house after his wife died. She cleaned and cooked. At dinner time, she'd slat out everything on the table at once, from salad to dessert, because that's the way old black grandpa liked it. Dessert was always cake or pudding. It was put down on a little plate or in a little dish next to your dinner plate so you could look at it and want it while you plowed through the other muck. Grandpa's hard and fast rule was you could look at dessert, but you couldn't eat dessert unless you finished every bite of fried meat and boiled greens and mashed potatoes. You even had to clean up the gravy, which was lumpy and didn't have much taste. If it wasn't all gone, Black Grandpa'd hand me a hunk of bread and say, 'Sop up with that, Dickie Bird. Make that plate shine like the dog licked it.' That's what he called me, Dickie Bird. Sometimes I couldn't finish no matter what, and then I didn't get the cake or the pudding. He'd take it and eat it himself. And sometimes when I could finish all my dinner, I'd find he'd smashed a cigarette butt into my piece of cake or my vanilla pudding. He could do that because he always sat next to me. He'd make like it was a big joke. 'Oops, Mr. Ashtray,' he'd say. My Ma and Pa never put a stop to it, although they must have known that even if it was a joke, it wasn't a fair one to play on a child. They just made out like it was a joke, too."
"That's really bad," Danny said. "Your folks should have stood up for you. My mom does. My daddy would, too."
"They were scared of him, and they were right to be scared. Andy Halloran was a bad, bad motorcycle. He'd say, 'Go on, Dickie, eat around it. That won't poison you.' If I took a bite, he'd have Nani, that was his housekeeper's name, bring me a fresh dessert. If I wouldn't, It just sat there. It got so I could never finish my meal because my stomach would get all upset.
You should have moved your cake or pudding to the other side of your plate, Danny said.
I tried that, sure, I wasn't born foolish. He'd just move it back, saying dessert went on the right.
Dick paused, looking out at the water, where a long white boat was trundling slowly across the dividing line between the sky and the Gulf of Mexico. Sometimes when he got me alone, he bit me. And once, when I said I'd tell my pa if he didn't leave me alone, he put a cigarette out on my bare foot. He said, "Tell him that too and see what good it does you. Your daddy knows my ways already and he'll never say a word because he yeller, and because he wants the money I got in the bank when I die, which I ain't fixin' to do soon."
Danny listened in wide-eyed fascination. He had always thought the story of Bluebeard was the scariest of all time, the scariest there ever could be. But this one was worse, because it was true.
Sometimes he said that he knew a bad man named Charlie Manx, and if I didn't do what he wanted, he'd call Charlie Manx on the long distance, and he'd come in his fancy car and take me away to a place for bad children. Then Grandpa would put his hand between my legs and commence squeezing. "So you ain't gonna say a thing, Dickie Bird. If you do, old Charlie will come and keep you with the other children he done stole until you die. And when you do, you go to hell and your body will burn forever because you peached. It don't matter if anybody believes you or not, peaching is peaching."
For a long time, I believed that old bastard. I didn't even tell my white grandma, the one with the shining, because I was afraid she'd think it was my fault. If I'd been older, I would have known better, but I was just a kid. He paused. There was something else, too.
"Do you know what it was, Danny?"
Danny looked into Dick's face for a long time, probing the thoughts and images behind his forehead. At last he said, "You wanted your father to get the money, but he never did."
"No. Black Grandpa left it all to a home for Negro orphans in Alabama, and I bet I know why, too. But that's neither here nor there."
"And your good grandma never knew? She never guessed?"
"She knew there was something, but I kept it blocked away, and she left me alone about it. Just told me that when I was ready to talk, she was ready to listen. Danny, when Andy Halloran died, it was a stroke. I was the happiest boy on earth. My ma said I didn't have to go to the funeral, that I could stay with Grandma Rose, my white grandma, if I wanted to, but I wanted to go. You bet I did. I wanted to make sure old Black Grandpa was really dead. It rained that day. Everybody stood around a grave under black umbrellas. I watched his coffin, the biggest and best one in his shop, I have no doubt, go into the ground. And I thought about all the times he'd twisted my balls and all the cigarette butts in my cake and the one he put out on my foot and how he ruled the dinner table like the crazy old king in that Shakespeare play. But most of all, I thought about Charlie Manx, who Grandpa had no doubt made up out of whole cloth, and how Black Grandpa could never call Charlie Manx on a long distance to come in the night and take me away in his fancy car to live with the other stolen boys and girls. I peeped over the edge of the grave. "Let the boy see," my pa said when my ma tried to pull me back, and I scoped the coffin down in that wet hole, and I thought, "Down there you're 6 feet closer to hell, Black Grandpa, and pretty soon you'll be all the way, and I hope the devil gives you 1,000 with a hand that's on fire."
Dick reached into his pants pocket and brought out a pack of Marlboros with a book of matches tucked under the cellophane. He put a cigarette in his mouth and then had to chase it with the match because his hand was trembling and his lips were trembling, too. Danny was astounded to see tears standing in Dick's eyes. Now knowing where this story was headed, Danny asked, "When did he come back?" Dick dragged deep on his cigarette and exhaled smoke through a smile. "You didn't need to peek inside my head to get that, did you?"
"Nope."
6 months later, I came home from school one day, and he was laying naked on my bed with his half-rotted prick all red up. He said, "You come on and sit on this, Dickie Bird. You give me 1,000, and I'll give you 2,000. I screamed, but there was no one there to hear it.
My ma and pa, they was both working, my ma in a restaurant, my dad at a printing press. I ran out and slammed the door, and I heard Black Grandpa get up, thump, and cross the room, thump, thump, thump. And what I heard next, fingernails, Danny said in a voice that was hardly there, scratching on the door. That's right. I didn't go in again until that night when my ma and pa were both home. He was gone, but there were leavings. Sure, like in our bathroom, because he was going bad. That's right. I changed the bed myself, which I could do because my ma showed me how 2 years before. She said I was too old to need a housekeeper anymore, that housekeepers were for little white boys and girls like the one she took care of before she got her hostessing job at Birkin Steakhouse. About a week later, I see old Black Grandpa in the park, a-settin' in a swing. He had his suit on, but it was all covered with gray stuff, the mold that was growing on it down in his coffin, I think. Yeah, Danny said. He spoke in a glassy whisper. It was all he could manage. His fly was open, though, with his work sticking out. I'm sorry to tell you all this, Danny. You're too young to hear about such things, but you need to know. Did you go to the white grandma then? Had to, because I knew what you know. He'd just keep coming back. Not like... Danny, have you ever seen dead people? Regular dead people, I mean. He laughed because that sounded funny. It did to Danny, too. Ghosts. A few times. Once there were three of them standing around a railroad crossing. Two boys and a girl. Teenagers. I think... Maybe they got killed there. Dick nodded. Mostly they stick close to where they crossed over until they finally get used to being dead and move on. Some of the folks you saw in the Overlook were like that. I know. The relief in being able to talk about these things to someone who knew was indescribable. And this one time there was a woman at a restaurant, the kind, you know, where they have tables outside. Dick nodded again. I couldn't see through that one, but no one else saw her, and when a waitress pushed in the chair she was sitting in, the ghost lady disappeared. Do you see them sometimes?
Not for years, but you're stronger in the shining than I was. It goes back some as you get older.
Good, Danny said fervently.
But you'll have plenty left even when you're grown up, I think, because you started with so much. Regular ghosts aren't like the woman you saw in room 217 and again in your bathroom. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, Danny said. Mrs. Massey's real. She leaves pieces of herself. You saw them. So did Mom. And she doesn't shine.
Let's walk back, Dick said. It's time you saw what I brought you.
8.
The return to the parking lot was even slower because Dick was winded. Cigarettes, he said. Don't ever start, Danny.
Mom smokes. She doesn't think I know, but I do.
Dick, what did your white grandma do? She must have done something because your black grandpa never got you.
She gave me a present, same like I'm going to give you. That's what a teacher does when a pupil is ready. Learning itself is a present, you know. The best one anybody can give or get.
She wouldn't call Grandpa anybody's name. She just called him, Dick grinned, the prevert. I said what you said, that he wasn't a ghost, he was real. And she said, yes, that was true, because I was making him real, with the shining. She said that some spirits, angry spirits mostly, won't go on from this world, because they know what's waiting for them is even worse. Most eventually starve away to nothing, but some of them find food. That's what the shining is to them, Dick, she told me. Food. You're feeding that prevert. You don't mean to, but you are. He's like a mosquito who keeps circling and then landing for more blood. Can't do nothing about that. What you can do is turn what he came for against him.
They were back at the Cadillac. Dick unlocked the doors, then slid behind the steering wheel with a sigh of relief.
Once upon a time, I could have walked 10 miles and run another 5. Nowadays, a little walk down the beach and my back feels like a horse kicked it. Go on, Danny. Open your present.
Danny stripped off the silver paper and discovered a box made of green, painted metal. On the front, below the latch, was a little keypad.
Hey, neat.
Yeah, you like it? Good. I got it at the Western Auto. Pure American steel. The one white Grandma Rose gave me had a padlock with a little key I wore around my neck, but that was long ago. This is the 1980s, the modern age. See the number pad? What you do is put in 5 numbers you're sure you won't forget, then push the little button that says set. Then any time you want to open a box, you punch your code. Danny was delighted.
Thanks, Dick. I'll keep my special things in it.
These would include his best baseball cards, his Cub Scouts compass badge, his lucky green rock, and a picture of him and his father, taken on the front lawn of the apartment building where they'd lived in Boulder before the Overlook, before things turned bad.
That's fine, Danny. I want you to do that, but I want you to do something else.
What?
I want you to know this box inside and out. Don't just look at it. Touch it. Feel it all over. Then stick your nose inside and see if there's a smell. It needs to be your closest friend, at least for a while.
Why?
Because you're going to put another one just like it in your mind. One that's even more special. And the next time that massive bitch comes around, you'll be ready for her. I'll tell you how, just like old white Grandma told me.
Danny didn't talk much on the ride back to the apartment. He had a lot to think about. He held his present, a lockbox made of strong metal, on his lap.
9. Mrs. Massey returned a week later. She was in the bathroom again, this time in the tub. Danny wasn't surprised. A tub was where she had died after all. This time, he didn't run. This time, he went inside and closed the door. She beckoned him forward, smiling.
Danny came, also smiling. In the other room, he could hear the television. His mother was watching Three's Company.
"Hello, Mrs. Massey," Danny said. "I brought you something."
At the last moment, she understood and began to scream.
10.
Moments later, his mom was knocking at the bathroom door. "Danny, are you all right?"
"Fine, Mom."
The tub was empty. There was some goo in it, but Danny thought he could clean that up. A little water would send it right down the drain.
"Do you have to go? I'll be out pretty soon."
"No, I thought I heard you call."
Danny grabbed his toothbrush and opened the door.
"I'm 100% cool, see?"
He gave her a big smile. It wasn't hard now that Mrs. Massey was gone.
The troubled look left her face.
"Good. Make sure you brush the back ones. That's where the food goes to hide."
"I will, Mom."
From inside his head, far inside where the twin of his special lockbox was stored on a special shelf, Danny could hear muffled screaming. He didn't mind. He thought it would stop soon enough, and he was right.
11. 2 years later, on the day before the Thanksgiving break, halfway up a deserted stairwell in Alafia Elementary, Horace Derwent appeared to Danny Torrance. There was confetti on the shoulders of his suit. A little black mask hung from one decaying hand. He reeked of the grave.
"Great party, isn't it?" he asked.
Danny turned and walked away very quickly. When school was over, he called Dick long distance at the restaurant where Dick worked in Key West.
"Another one of the Overlook people found me. How many boxes can I have, Dick? In my head, I mean."
Dick chuckled.
As many as you need, honey.
That's the beauty of the Shining. You think my black grandpa's the only one I ever had to lock away?
Do they die in there? This time there was no chuckle. This time there was a coldness in Dick's voice the boy had never heard before. Do you care?
Danny didn't.
When the one-time owner of the Overlook showed up again shortly after New Year's, this time in Danny's bedroom closet, Danny was ready. He went into the closet and closed the door. Shortly afterward, a second mental lockbox went up on the high mental shelf beside the one that held Mrs. Massey. There was more pounding and some inventive cursing that Danny saved for his own later use. Pretty soon it stopped. There was silence from the Derwent lockbox as well as the Massey lockbox. Whether or not they were alive, in their undead fashion, no longer mattered. What mattered was they were never getting out. He was safe. That was what he thought then. Of course, he also thought he would never take a drink, not after seeing what it had done to his father. Sometimes we just get it wrong.
Rattlesnake. 1. Her name was Andrea Steiner, and she liked movies, but she didn't like men. This wasn't surprising, since her father had raped her for the first time when she was 8. He had gone on raping her for that same number of years. Then she had put a stop to it, first popping his balls, one after the other, with one of her mother's knitting needles, and then putting that same needle, red and dripping, in her rapist sire's left eye socket. The balls had been easy, because he was sleeping, but the pain had been enough to wake him, in spite of her special talent. She was a big girl, though, and he was drunk. She had been able to hold him down with her body just long enough to administer the coup de grace. Now she had years, 8 times 4. She was a wanderer on the face of America, and an ex-actor had replaced the peanut farmer in the White House. The new fellow had an actor's unlikely black hair and an actor's charming, untrustworthy smile. Andy had seen one of his movies on TV. In it, the man who would be president played a guy who lost his legs when a train ran over them. She liked the idea of a man without legs. A man without legs couldn't chase you down and rape you. Movies, they were the thing. Movies took you away. You could count on popcorn and happy endings. You got a man to go with you. That way it was a date and he paid. This movie was a good one, with fighting and kissing and loud music. It was called Raiders of the Lost Ark. Her current date had his hand under her skirt high up on her bare thigh, but that was all right. A hand wasn't a prick. She had met him in a bar. She met most of the men she went on dates with in bars. He bought her a drink, but a free drink wasn't a date. It was just a pickup. "What's this about?" he'd asked her, running the tip of his finger over her upper left arm. She was wearing a sleeveless blouse, so the tattoo showed. She liked the tattoo to show when she was out looking for a date. She wanted men to see it. They thought it was kinky. She had gotten it in San Diego the year after she killed her father. "It's a snake," she said. "A rattler. Don't you see the fangs?" Of course he did. They were big fangs, out of all proportion to the head. A drop of poison hung from one. He was a businessman type in an expensive suit, with lots of combed-back presidential hair, and the afternoon off from whatever paper-pushing crap he did for work. His hair was mostly white instead of black, and he looked about 60, close to twice her age. But that didn't matter to men. He wouldn't have cared if she was 16 instead of 32, or 8. She remembered something her father had said once. "If they're old enough to pee, they're old enough for me." "Of course I see them," the man who was now sitting beside her had said. "But what does it mean?"
"Maybe you'll find out," Andy replied. She touched her upper lip with her tongue. "I have another tattoo, somewhere else."
"Can I see it?"
Maybe. Do you like movies?
He had frowned. What do you mean?
You want to date me, don't you?
He knew what that meant, or what it was supposed to mean. There were other girls in this place, and when they spoke of dates, they meant one thing, but it was not what Andy meant.
Sure. You're cute.
Then take me on a date. A real date. Raiders of the Lost Ark is playing at the Rialto.
I was thinking more of that little hotel 2 blocks down, darling. A room with a wet bar and a balcony. How does that sound?
She had put her lips close to his ear and let her breasts press against his arm. Maybe later. Take me to the movies first. Pay my way and buy me popcorn. The dark makes me amorous.
And here they were, with Harrison Ford on the screen, big as a skyscraper and snapping a bullwhip in the desert dust. The old guy with the presidential hair had his hand under her skirt, but she had a tub of popcorn placed firmly on her lap, making sure he could get most of the way down the third baseline, but not quite to home plate. He was trying to go higher, which was annoying, because she wanted to see the end of the movie and find out what was in the Lost Ark. So...
2. At 2 p.m. on a weekday, the movie theater was almost deserted, but 3 people sat 2 rows back from Andy Steiner and her date. 2 men, one quite old and one appearing on the edge of middle age, but appearances could be deceiving, flanked a woman of startling beauty. Her cheekbones were high, her eyes were gray, her complexion creamy. Her masses of black hair were tied back with a broad velvet ribbon. Usually, she wore a hat, an old and battered top hat, but she had left it in her motorhome this day. You didn't wear a tall topper in a movie theater. Her name was Rose O'Hara, but the nomadic family she traveled with called her Rose the Hat. The man edging into middle age was Barry Smith. Although 100% Caucasian, he was known in this same family as Barry the Chink because of his slightly upturned eyes.
"Now watch this," he said. "It's interesting."
"The movie's interesting,"
the old man Grandpa Flick grunted, but that was just his usual contrariness. He was also watching the couple 2 rows down.
"It better be interesting," Rose said, "because the woman's not all that steamy. A little, but..."
"There she goes, there she goes," Barry said as Andy leaned over and put her lips to her date's ear.
Barry was grinning, the box of gummy bears in his hand forgotten.
"I've watched her do it 3 times, and I still get a kick out of it."
3.
Mr. Businessman's ear was filled with a thatch of wiry white hairs and clotted with wax the color of shit. But Andy didn't let that stop her. She wanted to blow this town, and her finances were at a dangerously low ebb. "Aren't you tired?" she whispered in the disgusting ear. "Don't you want to go to sleep?" The man's head immediately dropped onto his chest, and he began to snore. Andy reached under her skirt, plucked up the relaxing hand, and placed it on the armrest. Then she reached into Mr. Businessman's expensive-looking suit coat and began to rummage. His wallet was in the inside left pocket. That was good. She wouldn't have to make him get up off his fat ass. Once they were asleep, moving them could be tricky. She opened the wallet, tossed the credit cards on the floor, and looked for a few moments at the pictures. Mr. Businessman with a bunch of other overweight Mr. Businessmen on the golf course. Mr. Businessman with his wife. A much younger Mr. Businessman standing in front of a Christmas tree with his son and 2 daughters. The daughters were wearing Santa hats and matching dresses. He probably hadn't been raping them, but it was not out of the question. Men would rape when they could get away with it, this she had learned. At her father's knee, so to speak. There was over $200 in the bill compartment. She had been hoping for even more,
The bar where she had met him catered to a better class of whore than those out by the airport. But it wasn't bad for a Thursday matinee, and there were always men who wanted to take a good-looking girl to the movies where a little heavy petting would only be the appetizer. Or so they hoped.
4. Okay, Rose murmured and started to get up. I'm convinced. Let's give it a shot.
But Barry put a hand on her arm, restraining her.
No, wait, watch. This is the best part.
5.
Andy leaned close to the disgusting ear again and whispered, Sleep deeper, as deep as you can. The pain you feel will only be a dream. She opened her purse and took out a pearl-handled knife. It was small, but the blade was razor-sharp. What will the pain be?
Only a dream, Mr. Businessman muttered into the knot of his tie.
That's right, sweetie. She put an arm around him and quickly slashed double V's into his right cheek, a cheek so fat it would soon be a jowl. She took a moment to admire her work in the chancy light of the projector's colored dream beam. Then the blood sheeted down. He would wake up with his face on fire, the right arm of his expensive suit coat drenched and in need of an emergency room.
And how will you explain it to your wife? You'll think of something, I'm sure. But unless you have plastic surgery, you'll see my marks every time you look in the mirror. And every time you go looking for a little strange in one of the bars, you'll remember how you got bitten by a rattlesnake. One in a blue skirt and a white sleeveless blouse.
She tucked the 250s and 520s into her purse, clicked it shut, and was about to get up when a hand fell on her shoulder, and a woman murmured in her ear,
Hello, dear. You can see the rest of the movie another time. Right now, you're coming with us.
Andy tried to turn, but hands seized her head. The terrible thing about them was that they were inside.
After that, until she found herself in Rose's Earth Cruiser in a going-to-seed campground on the outskirts of this Midwestern city, all was darkness.
6.
When she woke up, Rose gave her a cup of tea and talked to her for a long time. Andy heard everything, but most of her attention was taken up by the woman who had abducted her. She was a presence, and that was putting it mildly. Rose the Hat was 6 feet tall, with long legs and tapered white slacks and high breasts inside a T-shirt branded with the UNICEF logo and motto, Whatever It Takes to Save a Child. Her face was that of a calm queen, serene and untroubled. Her hair, now unbound, tumbled halfway down her back. The scuffed top hat, cocked on her head, was jarring, but otherwise she was the most beautiful woman Andy Steiner had ever seen.
Do you understand what I've been telling you? I'm giving you an opportunity here, Andy, and you should not take it lightly. It's been 20 years or more since we've offered anyone what I'm offering to you.
And if I say no? What then? Do you kill me? And take this, what had she called it? This steam?
Rose smiled. Her lips were rich and coral pink. Andy, who considered herself asexual, nonetheless wondered what that lipstick would taste like.
You don't have enough steam to bother with, dear, and what you do have would be far from yummy. It would taste the way the meat from a tough old cow tastes to a rube.
To a what?
Never mind. Just listen. We won't kill you. What we'll do if you say no is to wipe out all memory of this little conversation. You will find yourself on the side of the road outside some nothing town, Topeka maybe, or Fargo, with no money, no identification, and no memory of how you got there. The last thing you'll remember is going into that movie theater with the man you robbed and mutilated.
He deserved to be mutilated, Andy spat out.
Rose stood on her tiptoes and stretched, her fingers touching the roof of the RV.
That's your business, honey doll. I'm not your psychiatrist.
She wasn't wearing a bra. Andy could see the shifting punctuation marks of her nipples against her shirt.
But here's something to consider. We'll take your talent as well as your money and your no doubt bogus identification. The next time you suggest that a man go to sleep in a darkened movie theater, he'll turn to you and ask what the fuck you're talking about.
Andy felt a cold trickle of fear. You can't do that. But she remembered the terribly strong hands that had reached inside her brain and felt quite sure this woman could. She might need a little help from her friends, the ones in the RVs and motorhomes gathered around this one like piglets at a sow's teats. But oh yes, she could. Rose ignored this.
How old are you, dear?
28.
She had been shading her age since hitting the big 3-0. Rose looked at her smiling, saying nothing. Andy met those beautiful gray eyes for 5 seconds, then had to drop her gaze. But what her eyes fell upon when she did were those smooth breasts, unharnessed but with no sign of a sag. And when she looked up again, her eyes only got as far as the woman's lips, those coral pink lips.
You're 32, Rose said.
Oh, it only shows a little, because you've led a hard life, a life on the run.
But you're still pretty. Stay with us. Live with us. And 10 years from now, you really will be 28.
That's impossible.
Rose smiled.
100 years from now, you'll look and feel 35. Until you take steam, that is. Then you'll be 28 again. Only you'll feel 10 years younger. And you'll take steam often. Live long, stay young, and eat well. Those are the things I'm offering. How do they sound?
Too good to be true, Andy said. Like those ads about how you can get life insurance for $10.
She wasn't entirely wrong. Rose hadn't told any lies, at least not yet, but there were things she wasn't saying. Like how steam was sometimes in short supply. Like how not everyone lived through the turning. Rose judged this one might, and Walnut, the true's jackleg doctor, had cautiously concurred, but nothing was sure.
And you and your friends call yourself?
They're not my friends. They're my family. We're the true knot.
Rose laced her fingers together and held them in front of Andy's face.
And what's tied can never be untied. You need to understand that.
Andy, who already knew that a girl who has been raped can never be unraped, understood perfectly.
Do I really have any other choice?
Rose shrugged.
Only bad ones, dear. But it's better if you want it. It will make the turning easier.
Does it hurt, this turning?
Rose smiled and told the first outright lie.
Not at all.
7. A summer night on the outskirts of a Midwestern city. Somewhere people were watching Harrison Ford snap his bullwhip. Somewhere the actor president was no doubt smiling his untrustworthy smile. Here, in this campground, Andy Steiner was lying on a discount store lawn recliner, bathed in the headlights of Rose's Earth Cruiser and someone else's Winnebago. Rose had explained to her that, while the True Knot owned several campgrounds, this wasn't one of them. But their advance man was able to four-wall places like this, businesses tottering on the edge of insolvency. America was suffering a recession, but for the True, money was not a problem.
"Who is this advance man?" Andy had asked.
"Oh, he's a very winning fellow," Rose had said, smiling. "Able to charm the birdies down from the trees. You'll meet him soon."
"Is he your special guy?"
Rose had laughed at that and caressed Andy's cheek. The touch of her fingers caused a hot little worm of excitement in Andy's stomach. Crazy, but there it was.
You've got a twinkle.